This is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. On the show today, we have actually three guests, two of whom we have mentioned earlier today, and one was a surprise to me earlier this morning that we were going to have that opportunity. David Commande is the music director of the newly formed Heartland Festival Orchestra, which is giving its first concert on Friday evening. Their soloist is a guest pianist, Antonio Pompobaldi, and he was the surprise. So we'll have conversations with both of those gentlemen. And we will start the show with a visit with Natalie Ellis, who runs something called Class Act, Interactive Education and Entertainment, I think they're called. She will correct me if I have the title slightly wrong. But Natalie is with us to tell us about that project, which is based in Champaign. It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. The opening movement of Mozart's Eine kleine Nachtmusik, or A Little Night Music, how it's generally translated, played here by the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, and you can hear it played as part of the opening concert of the Heartland Festival Orchestra Friday evening in Peoria. We'll have a conversation with its music director, David Commande, later on in the show, and also their piano soloist. First on the show, Natalie Ellis, who is founder and creative director of, and I have the title right this time, Class Act Interactive Education and Events. is the word I got wrong earlier. Natalie, originally from Champaign, got her degree in musical theater from Ball State University, moved to New York City, worked as an actor and teaching artist, and did quite a number of things in improvisational theater and other things which we will let her tell you about. She is back in Champaign with this Class Act Interactive, which was her own invention, I believe. So welcome to Live and Local, Natalie. And once again, I have I'm having a throat problem, as I had the last two mornings for some reason. So I'll clear that out in a moment while you tell us a little bit more about your own background and how you ended up creating this organization.
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much, Kevin. It's been really exciting for me to be back in Champaign, where kind of everything started. I grew up here doing shows with CUTC and went to Centennial High School, and Sue Aldridge was my drama teacher. And that was really when I kind of got the bug for performing. And after training, you know, to be a professional performer and performing in New York for many years, I loved it so much, but didn't feel like it was completely everything that I was supposed to do. And I was working with an improv company there, doing some teaching artist work. And that's when I kind of heard that little ding, like, okay, I really want to do something where I'm combining performing and teaching. And that's when kind of the seeds for Class Act started. I also, after getting my master's in educational theater from New York University, moved to Chicago and was working in education and theater there. And then recently I decided, you know, okay, it's time. I'm ready to make the jump and do my own thing after kind of learning a lot from other nonprofit organizations and theater companies. And I couldn't think of a better place to start my own company than back in Champaign, where I had kind of gotten the bug. So what I'm doing is basically combining its creative drama and improvisation and classes to kind of inspire kids and adults to make up their own content. We're working on original material, and just focusing on developing creativity in young ones and also helping adults to tap into that again as well.
What would you say is the overall goal? I mean, what do you hope people will get out of this thing and take beyond?
That's a good question. I think basically looking at theater as more than just, you know, performance during the shows, but really something that can, you know, enrich and enhance your life overall, whether it's from an educational standpoint, helping teachers kind of bring the curriculum to life through drama, or whether it's from, you know, just a stance of building confidence for young people. There's so many ways that theater can kind of help young people develop and also give them, certainly there's that joy that you get from performing for an audience, but also kind of giving people a way to tap into that without an audience as well, just stretching their imagination and bringing a little bit. We're so structured in our everyday life and education system, kind of bringing the creativity and joy back to learning.
You said you've mentioned young people a few times, and of course you said you also do work with adult folk. But talk about some of the range of classes, because you do range from quite young to, I suppose, potentially quite old if
right.
they're interested.
Exactly. We have classes for ages 3 to adult. So our kind of more early childhood classes, the 3 to 5-year-olds, we teach a class called Imagination Station, and it combines drama, music, and creative movement, and also visual art, and gives them a chance to explore. It's really a fusion of all those art forms and combining creative play in that as well. So that is a lot of fun for the little ones. And they're, you know, stretching their minds, working on developing imagery, things that are really kind of sophisticated higher order thinking skills, but from a stance of play. Then for 6 to 8-year-olds, we have story drama, and that we're looking at, you know, we take a different story each week and we act it out, but also, create alternate endings or think about, really try to look at things from a character's point of view, give them a chance to feel what it's like to embody a character from a book. And then that I've found, really helps them with comprehension of the story and looking at reading from a different way as well.
Are there ways in which you attempt to or encourage the students or parents to attempt to combine what you're doing with whatever they may be learning in school?
Right, definitely. That's a great point. There are a lot of techniques that we use that can certainly be extended into the home, whether it's during story time. There are certain, you know, follow-up questions or things that the students get used to doing in class that parents can do at home. And I also work a lot with teachers into, you know, okay, how can you bring the curriculum to life?
You have beyond the you mentioned the two younger groups, and then you do continue with segments. It seems like basically 4 to 5 year segments of students up through high school, calling the older groups 8 to 12 and 13 to 18 kid prov, teen prov, and then eventually improv classes for both adults and for people who are actually acting. Talk about a little bit about the progress from. Let's say somebody were to start when they're 8.
Right, great. Well, we start with improvisation classes. That is actually a really fun time to start in improvisation because the kids haven't necessarily developed the same inhibitions that, you know, we may have as adults. They're ready to just jump in, try anything. We start at that age. I start with kind of structured short form, what we call short form games, improvisational games. So these theater games teach the skills of, teamwork and cooperation, making your partner look good, accepting offers, and also teaching them to, have confidence and not be afraid to take a creative risk and put themselves out there. And we have a lot of fun with these goofy games that underneath they're teaching the skills that will be important in scene building as they get a little bit older and are able to understand the concepts that are necessary to develop improvisational skills.
Once they become adults,
Right.
The inhibitions kick in. Right.
Right. That becomes a little bit trickier sometimes. But and so even for the adult classes, for our beginning adult classes, I try to start off, I guess, at a little less steep of a pace. We take some time to make sure everyone feels safe and comfortable. And sometimes they may have never stretched this part of their brain or experienced what it's like to never be wrong. That's the thing in improv, or I guess I should phrase that in a positive way. Everything you say is right. They're really encourage them to understand that they can't fail with this. We're all in this together to support each other and build something together. And sometimes it takes a while to kind of train that muscle that, hey, let's.
Yeah, what muscle is that? I want to get that muscle worked on. that gets in the way.
Right.
Are you a solo act, or you have colleagues working with you in class act?
I do have a group of improvisers that are working with me. We have our resident improv team now that we've recently formed and been working together. That is Matt Fear, Robbie Boyer, Samantha Gold, Alicia Ray, Aubrey Wachtel, Kara Morizzi, and Tanino Minecci. And there it's kind of a great compilation of local actors, university students, as well as there's already a great improv theater community here. And I'm hoping with Class Act to kind of bring those groups together and give them a space to perform. And also some of the members of our Class Act resident team are in other improv groups in the city.
Besides doing the classes, you also do some performing. In particular, personalized parties, I'm curious about.
Oh, yes. Exactly. So really, the kids' imagination is the limit, or adults. So you can have a grown-up party at Class Act, too. But we do a range from you can have your own improv show at your party where the birthday boy or girl gets to be the guest of honor, and we improvise scenes and have either around their life or their hobbies, interests, things like that. So it becomes a completely tailored show for them. That's what I love about improv. You can really shape it in any way that you want.
And this is that improv group you've mentioned of local
right.
people who are actually doing this a lot.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So they're trained and ready to be very flexible, and we can create a show around a specific person or event. We also have our bi-monthly shows. We're starting October 10th. We're going to be performing every second and fourth Saturday at our space, which is 114 South Neal, so just below the Conservatory of Central Illinois. These shows, it's called Theater Sports. And theater sports is a format that was developed by Keith Johnstone in 1977, I believe. He is an improv guru and thought, you know, sports teams get so much attention and the audiences get so riled up and excited about what they're seeing. How can we do that for live theater? And so he developed this format where it's a competition, two teams of improvisers competing together. And it really is a great way to engage an audience and have a lot of fun. So we will be performing our show Theater Sports every second and fourth Saturday.
There was a place in Chicago that had a name like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what it was called?
Yeah, there are a couple of branches. There's the International Theater Sports is what we are a licensed part of. So we're the only theater sports company in Illinois. And Comedy Sports was an offshoot of that. People might also be familiar with the show Whose Line Is It Anyway? Theater Sports, Whose Line Is It Anyway? And Comedy Sports are kind of a similar type of improv format where it's short form scenes.
I think Comedy Sports is the one I was thinking of. I really mm-hmm. hadn't thought about that at all until you just mentioned it, and I was curious about it at the time, and I never did go to see any productions there. The group that I often see advertising for, and of course I'm now going to completely blank on the name of it, but Kara is in...
Oh, yes, Zoo.
Zoo Improv. Thank you very much, because I don't have my calendar in here, which I actually need to get before the show is out. We'll do that a little later. You mentioned improv competition. Have you thought about doing shows where it's you against them?
Right. Well, we have talked about that. There's three We call them the three guest champagne groups. So there's Class Act, Abe Froman, excuse me, is another group, and Zoo Improv certainly is very active in the community. So yeah, we've talked about having a tournament of sorts. Actually, which would be
tournament,
fun.
Yeah,
right, a tournament of champions. The one fun thing we were talking about actually at rehearsal last night with our resident company is that even though it is a competition, since we are all part of the same group, you know, where both sides are really striving to just make the best show that we can. So it's, you know, you may cooperate with people on the other team during the course of the show. So even though it's a mock competition, it all ends up, you know, everyone working together to make the show the best it can be. But yes, we have talked about a citywide theater sports tournament. And we're actually doing Abe Froman, one of the other downtown groups, they perform at Mike and Molly's on Mondays at 9. They are sponsoring an event called Mollypalooza to raise money for the Girls Fight Back is the name of the organization to empower young women in September. And all three of the city improv groups will be performing there.
I love that name, Mollypalooza. I just actually saw Molly the other day, the Molly of Mike and Molly's, who is Mike's brother, the Murphys, in connection with a project you were involved in. Last Saturday, we had the thing about which we talked on this show on Friday, the Kathy Murphy Encore presentation. And all the Murphys were there, and many of them actually participated in the show. And I hadn't seen Molly in quite a while. She is no longer Murphy. I forget what her last name is, but I should remember. In any event, Mollypalooza, that sounds like a lot of fun. And then you do other forms of community engagement.
Right, exactly. That's something that at Class Act we're working towards. I'd really like it to be a space. Right now we have a large space in downtown Champaign, a stage. We're using it for, certainly for our improv shows. The Conservatory of Central Illinois is using it as a stage for them as well. And also we want it to be a place where community artists can come and perform it for an intimate audience. And it's a little bit different than... you know, sometimes musicians or improvisers are performing in a bar, which is great because you have that automatic audience kind of built in. But this is really a space that is built for that. And so we'd love to invite other people to come and utilize the space. The Champaign Park District Youth Theater is now, we are their home away from home for their productions. They did two productions in the space this summer and will be continuing their season there through the rest of the year. So that is really excellent. We're so excited that it can be such a multi-purpose space and used for, you know, children, youth, ages 3 all the way to adult.
Adult and beyond.
Adult and beyond.
We're talking with Natalie Ellis, who is founder and creative director of Class Act, interactive education and events based in downtown Champaign. If you're familiar with the area, it's where the music shop used to be before they moved out towards into one of the mall areas. And Class Act is there now. You can get there either side, Neal Street or Walnut Street. And if folks want more information, what's the best place to go?
Our website is www.classactinteractive.com. It's a little bit of a mouthful there.
Well, there it is, Class Act Interactive. That's not too bad. There are lots worse, and you can at least, they're all words one can spell easily enough. Natalie, thanks very much for coming on Live and Local today. And best of luck with this with the venture.
Great. Thank you so much.
This is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly on FM 90.9. That's the waltz from the Serenade for Strings by Peter Tchaikovsky, a performance here by the Moscow Chamber Orchestra. You can hear a performance of the complete Serenade for Strings this Friday evening in Peoria. It is part of the first concert being given by the Heartland Festival Orchestra. It's a chamber orchestra, brand new venture, that was inspired, although that's not really the right word, I suppose, by the recent events in Peoria, by which the board of directors of the Peoria Symphony decided they wanted a new music director. David Commandy, their director for more than a decade, I believe, or for about a decade. And the players weren't very happy with that decision, apparently. And they decided, along with David, to form this new group and make sure he stayed in town and continued to make music in Peoria. So they are doing their first concert Friday evening at 7:30, Five Points Washington, Caterpillar Performing Arts Center in Washington, Illinois. And earlier this morning, I had a conversation with David Commandy, the new music director of the orchestra, about the start of the group.
The Heartland Festival Orchestra came to be through the conversations and brain children of musicians who knew each other here in the area that were excited about some more chamber orchestra performances, performance opportunities. We all knew one another over many years of collaboration here in and around Peoria. And when they were in touch with some significant sponsors and volunteers at the outset, a little more than two months ago, we began to put the pieces together, and I was very excited to be invited as its initial artistic director. We've had a lot of fun and a lot of excitement in accomplishing the amazing list of tasks that are entailed in the inauguration and the launching of the new orchestra, as you can well imagine. You know, we had a long list of things to do, and we're within a few days of our first concert, and most of them have gotten done.
And, of course, the fact that they invited you to be the artistic director is hardly incidental, since, as I understand it anyway, you were a very large part of the reason for this getting going, because folks wanted to keep you around Peoria.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, that this first concert is nicknamed by me Favorites and Friends, and the reasons, of course, are there are musical favorites of both of mine and of most audience members. But the friends part, of course, is the players in the orchestra and also our wonderful soloist who agreed to be part of our inaugural performance, Antonio Pompobaldi. These are people that with whom I've been making music for some decade now. And as you well know and understand, you develop a musical and a personal relationship through many performances and many rehearsals, and we all wanted to keep it going, and I was so charged by the opportunity to continue here musically.
Talk about from your perspective what happened with the Peoria Symphony.
Peoria Symphony was ready to look at a change of direction, and they came to some conclusions about how they needed to do that. That was the opinion of a portion of its board. You know, my inclusion or not inclusion in that change of direction was up to them, and you know, they like most orchestras are facing the challenges of turning into the 21st century, understanding how to reach out to a broadening audience, or at least trying to make it broaden, and it just became apparent that the people on board were not the ideal combination. The solution that was chosen was to look for a new music director.
And just the fact that some of these players, so many of these players who have worked with you there wanted to, you know, start some kind of ensemble that would include you in it has to be a great testament to your work with them through the Peoria Symphony, in spite of whatever the board may think.
Well, I have to say that some musicians that I know have known for a while in New Jersey, where I am now also active as artistic director of the New Jersey Youth Symphony. Many musicians of the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra, of which I was associate conductor before coming to Peoria, when we had a reunion and they had followed from afar various events from last season, they said to me, "Well, David, we knew things were going all right for you in Peoria, but you must have been doing something right if after 10 years the musicians still wanted to perform with you." So, yes, I take it as a wonderful affirmation of the truly positive experience I've had with the players over the years. Right now I'm focusing on the future, which is the Heartland Festival Orchestra, and I'm truly excited. I mean, my anticipation of our first rehearsal on Thursday is so strong and positive. You know, the creation of the Heartland Festival Orchestra, a big part of its mission statement is the inclusion of the players in the governance of the organization. I've always felt, both as conductor and also as a cellist who continues to play, that the musicians of an orchestra are its greatest, strongest asset, and can and should be included in its guidance, in its governance. And so that's intrinsic to the mission statement of the Heartland Festival Orchestra. We have a player who is a voting member of the board, not merely invited to watch the discussion at the board meetings. We have a founding member of the board also in Amy Gilreath, who is the initial player representative as well on the board. And she and also colleagues of Amy's who are part of what I'm calling the Creative Council have given me ideas, musical and other ideas for performances. We're having an ongoing conversation about the music we're making and the way we're going to make music. So the players are at the heart of the Heartland Festival Orchestra. Meanwhile, we have truly idealistic board members and supporters who are excited about the way we want to make music, which is, I know, close to your heart, because I've seen that you are both innovative and you reach out to your audiences and you bring very interesting elements to your performances, and that's what we aspire to do. We're not going to be stuffy and formal and put on the black ties, although that's merely a symbolic element of the whole thing, but instead bring in visual elements, have conversation in and around the performance, and have a lot of fun for our audiences. Then the other element that's at the heart of our mission statement is that each concert will have a kind of partnership with a charity, which is the partial beneficiary of the performance. We will be sharing the proceeds of each of our performances with a select charity, a local charity, so that we're giving our thanks to the community. Not only with the music making, but also with a substantive benefit for the other charity. So our publicity outreach includes them, and we, as I said, we share some of the proceeds. And our first concert this Friday, we're working with a children's home, which has been helping young children in need of either family support or entire support, and they've been doing this for about 150 years, not quite a century and a half. It's a wonderful organization, and besides our donation to the organization, we're also inviting our concert goers to bring along some school supplies to the performance on Friday with them to donate to these kids.
Yeah, I saw that on your website. That's a pretty noble thing to be able to do, and it actually brings up a question in my mind that I was going to ask anyway, and that is, as a startup orchestra in this particular economy, how are you managing to come up with the money, and then how are you managing to have enough, how do you think you'll be able to manage to have enough left over to give some of it away?
Well, you know, this whole idea, ideas even powerful ideas, they may start in a modest fashion, but if they have that spark, you know, things catch fire. And within 48 hours of the first event to announce the formation of the orchestra, we had about 20% of the first season's budget donated or pledged. And it has gone on from there. There is just strong enthusiasm to support this. And in fact, we're inviting anybody who wants to donate to the orchestra up to our first concert. If they give $100 or more, they will always be listed as founders of the orchestra. And we've had a tremendously positive response. And word is going around. So we're more than three quarters sold in this concert. So people who are listening and would like to catch it, they should get to fivepointswashington.org or look it up online. There's tickets can be purchased that way.
And online is heartlandfestivalorchestra.org, or they should go to the Five Points website.
Fivepointswashington.org, yes.
Okay. And tell me about, I'm sitting here in Urbana, tell me about the Five Points Washington Caterpillar Performing Arts Center.
This hall is a very attractive, very comfortable new hall. It's just about 2 years old. And I actually had the pleasure of making the first orchestral music in the space when it opened a couple of years ago, this coming October. And it's a lovely space. It's for everyone. It's a feeling of intimacy. It has about about 1,000 seats. The acoustics are quite fine, actually. And it's in a facility. It's called Five Points because five different municipal organizations, including the library and the park district and other such entities, came together in the creation of the facility. So actually, this is one of the few concert halls where you can come to the concert. If you're really quick, you can get in a quick swim during intermission, return to the concert. the facility has banquet halls, and it also has a library attached, as well as the aquatic center and a workout center. But it's beautiful. The important thing is that the concert hall is very fine, and the people there have been marvelous in their hospitality to us.
Well, you've got a great idea there, David. You referred a couple of times obliquely to the mission of the Prairie Ensemble, which I conduct here in Champaign-Urbana, and we do these things at, rather than at intermission, we have what we call halftime surprises, and so now you've just set up what can be your special feature at intermission, is that everybody can go get a workout.
Well, and the mention of a surprise, I can tell that we're kindred spirits, because I really love the element of surprise and performance, preferably the enjoyable kind rather than unexpected notes and so forth. And there will be an element in every one of our concerts which is not published prior to the concert. And this is for a couple of reasons, one of which, of course, it's fun for people to imagine that or to know they will hear or see things that they're not certain of in advance, but also for us as performers and making the plans, There are sometimes ideas that I've always found this to be true, that arise well after the publication deadlines, which it's a pleasure to be able to bring in to the concert. And so I'm intentionally only publicizing in advance the main body of the performances, most of the performances. But there will always be some element or other which will be a surprise to the audience.
Well, why don't we tell listeners the part that isn't a surprise, since we haven't actually mentioned what's on the concert on Friday?
Well, we're opening with a lovely overture by Rossini, Il Signor Bruschino, one of his earliest three operas. And this piece, delightful as the Rossini overtures all are, has that wonderful and delightful element to musicologists, certainly, and to players, of percussive effects accomplished by the players in the second violin section. And this will be a this will be an effervescent opening to the program. And then another longtime favorite of mine, the Tchaikovsky Serenade for Strings. And I first encountered this piece actually conducting it for ballet, because in my first significant professional engagement, I was music director of the Boston Ballet, and early on we did George Balanchine's magnificent ballet set to this music. It's gorgeous. It has resonances with Mozart, because Tchaikovsky, besides being a huge admirer of Mozart's music, intentionally crafted his first movement here after the form of a sonatina in the spirit of Mozart. So obviously it's Russian Romanticism, but in a very classical vein. Then after the break, we are going to revisit the much-loved Eine kleine Nachtmusik, the serenade. And, you know, people never get tired of hearing it, and my feeling about that is a masterpiece deserves revisitation. And, in fact, this will be my first local performance of it. I'm really looking forward to that. And finally, we're going to conclude with the piano concerto, not in the typical spot on a program, but the Mozart A major piano concerto number 23, K488, is such a glorious work. I think it will succeed as the culmination of the program with our wonderful soloist, Antonio Pompobaldi.
Yeah, the concerto in more standard fashion of overture, concerto, and then symphony usually comes at the end of the first half. I guess it's fair to say that's the usual spot. And I was actually pleased to see that you are putting it at the end. We've certainly done that often enough as well. It gives a different kind of focus on the soloist.
It does. And, you know, my feeling about program design really has been evolving through the years. My feeling about concert style has been evolving, because I began my career with a very strong traditional classical training in Vienna, and a strong appreciation for that typical design of a program, overture, concerto, and symphony. And there's nothing wrong with it, but what is wrong is to always do it the same way and not explore opportunities to put different kinds of lighting on the different elements of the program. And similarly, speaking during performances, this is something that I was initially more reluctant to do, just out of a sense of traditionalism, I suppose, and also because I love for the music to speak for itself. And yet I found that people really enjoy hearing a human voice to help them connect with what's happening on the stage. And in the end, I think that's far more important than merely following the forms of traditionalism. So I actually now am wholeheartedly behind this kind of informality and personalizing the concert experience.
I read an article recently by a newspaper critic from somewhere out east, just scathing about the idea of clapping between movements of symphonies, for example.
Yeah.
Where do you come down on that issue?
I think that it's a laughable position when we realize that most of these great works, when they first were performed, and when I say great works, I mean in the absolute core of the repertoire in the 18th, 19th, and even the beginning of the, 18th and 19th centuries, certainly, they had their premieres, and often the audiences would not allow a symphony to continue unless they heard the movement, which they had just so enjoyed, played a second time. So, you know, what kind of authenticity are we seeking out? If music inspires people to need to clap, then I'm grateful. So, you know, I think we have to be flexible in our expectations and our reactions. And there are certain, for example, there are certain concerto opening movements that people perform, and it's hard to imagine how an audience can stop itself from clapping at the end of these movements. So I say, why allow that fear of doing the wrong thing to continue its unwelcome life in the concert hall.
Of course, a lot in the audience need to be trained that just because somebody gives in to their enthusiasm doesn't mean you turn around and glare at them as though they've committed a crime.
Well, you know, we have colleagues who will turn around and glare and,
sure,
and go tisk, 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 but I've never come near doing that. I mean, applause should be welcome to every performer, and you say, glad you liked it, and now we'll go on with the work.
Yeah, it means you're doing your job as players. You've generated excitement.
And I don't know if you've had this experience, but when I was studying in Vienna and going to the opera and going to the Musikverein, the performances, audiences over there were not so staid, especially in the opera house. And I've actually seen opera fans not merely booing after an aria, but literally getting into fist fights over the qualities of the tenor. Yeah. Now, we're not encouraging that in our concert audience behavior.
Oh, come on.
But, you know, as you well know, if you're a performer, polite indifference is the worst possible reaction.
Yeah, no kidding. You don't want that.
Yeah.
One way or another. If that's what you get, then you really wonder what you've done wrong.
Yeah.
Well, I don't imagine there'll be any fistfights between you and the soloist. It seems like you have a long relationship with Mr. Pompabaldi.
Antonio and I met, I think it was 2000 and maybe two, but probably 2003, when I first invited him as soloist with the Peoria Symphony. He came for Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto. And in our early conversations, I became aware that he loves chamber music, and not only that, that cello sonatas are about his favorite variety. And so we ended up scheduling and performing a chamber music concert with one another early the week of his concert visit for the concerto, and it was a huge hit. It went wonderfully, and we've been buddies ever since.
Any chamber music going to happen during his visit this week?
Well, we didn't have the time for that. He's just now returned from an extended trip to Europe, concertizing and giving master classes. But he will be giving a master class on Thursday afternoon at 3:30 at Five Points Washington. And that's open to the public and free of charge. Select number of students will play for him, and he'll make his comments and suggestions. He may demonstrate a few things, and it will be a delight, I'm sure, for those who attend. So then later that evening, we'll begin our rehearsals in the hall and get ready for Friday's performance.
So you're doing, what, a couple or three rehearsals for Friday?
That's right, yeah. And the players, crackerjack bunch that they are, everybody's arriving ready to go at the downbeat of the first rehearsal, and we will deliver it up fresh at the downbeat of the concert.
David Commanda, who's music director and founding music director of the Heartland Festival Orchestra, which will give its inaugural concert this Friday evening at 7:30, Five Points Washington, Caterpillar Performing Arts Center in Washington, Illinois. If you'd like tickets, you can go either to heartlandfestivalorchestra.org or fivepointswashington.org, and you spell out five, F-I-V-E. In a moment, a conversation with the soloist on that concert, Antonio Pompabaldi. Our broadcast today is supported in part by the Music Shop and Pro Sound Center, now in their new location at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign. The Music Shop specializes in the sales and rental of band and orchestra instruments, digital keyboards, guitars, amps, and drums, along with a wide variety of sheet music. Just after I talked with David Commande this morning, I had a unexpected opportunity to talk with the soloist for Friday's concert by the Heartland Festival Orchestra, Antonio Pompabaldi, who will be playing the very piano concerto that you are hearing in the background. I heard a little bit from David Commande about how you initially met, but talk about your relationship with him musically and otherwise, and how you ended up playing as soloist on the first concert of the Heartland Festival Orchestra.
Well, I met David, as you know, when we collaborated to play Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto, and that was back in 2002, I think. And then I was invited again to play Beethoven Fourth a couple of years later in 2004, and then in 2005 I played Tchaikovsky First, all with the Peoria Symphony and David at the helm. Since the very first collaboration, I felt that there was a very direct link between us as musicians, that we needed to speak very little about things, and we both allowed each other the flexibility necessary to make music at the same time, keeping things under control so that there would be no bad surprises and the performance would still make sense. after that, we also had a chance to play chamber music together. As you probably know, David is a very good cellist, and we played one recital. We played the Brahms E minor sonata for piano and cello. So our musical friendship became very deep and meaningful, and of course the personal friendship too, as our families met and spent some time together, you know, over, you know, those days when I came to Peoria to perform. So that's why it came to be, I guess, that David thought of me when he started this new adventure with the Heartland Festival Orchestra. And naturally, I immediately agreed because I love playing with him and I love Peoria. And I think it'll be exciting. And plus, he asked me to play the Mozart Concerto in A major, which is one of my absolute favorite concerti to play.
Well, I was about to ask who chose the concerto, whether it was he or you.
I actually had asked him if he would be interested in playing Beethoven Second, because, well, first of all, it's a great piece, and secondly, I just played it in France a few weeks ago. But he seemed, more interested in doing the Mozart, and I'm always up for that. I'm always particularly that specific concerto, which, strangely enough, I haven't had an opportunity to play in about 8 years, but that I have played very often, you know, in my life. It's probably the concerto I played the most. Certainly one of the very first I performed with orchestra.
And what makes it special from your point of view?
Well, how many hours have you got?
We have 7 minutes.
Well, the one thing I can tell you is the only adjective to describe it is just perfect. And the reason for it is it is the kind of music where not one single note is out of place, not one single statement is overstated, and the whole flows like oil. It's just incredible. And then it has all of the components. There is this first movement that begins in this very enticing way. I often compare it to a beautiful archway, entryway to this beautiful, ornate edifice of beautiful elegance, very aristocratic, a little bit on the melancholy side. And then the second movement is just one of the most heart-wrenching, saddest melodies that Mozart ever wrote. It's the only movement in F sharp minor, very, very deep, brings tears to your eyes, and it has a vocal quality to it. And then the last movement is pure fun, with this perpetuum mobile feeling, because it just never stops, and there is a seamless transition between the melodic parts and the ornamental parts on the piano part, switching back and forth with the orchestra seamlessly. So that's why I say it's just nothing but perfect. And then you have some elements of opera buffa. This concerto was written when Mozart was had just finished composing The Marriage of Figaro. The concerto was finished on March 2nd of 1786. You have some elements of opera buffa in the last movement, particularly, for example, the section in F sharp minor, which brings drama all of a sudden into it, and then it just transforms itself into the cheerful tune in D major for the clarinet. So the sudden change of scenario, stage, and mood, which is typical of opera buffa. There are many, many components to it, and then it's just very much fun to play. It fits under the fingers just perfectly.
Well, I was going to ask also, what are the particular challenges to it?
Well, the pianist? Like all Mozart's music, its transparency is what makes it challenging. It's music that's very, very difficult to play because it needs to be very well balanced dynamically and also rhythmically. It needs to be very clean because there is nowhere to hide. It's much easier to play a Rachmaninoff or a Tchaikovsky concerto where, you know, you can always slip a few wrong notes into the thunderous chords and octaves, you know, drowned in pedal, but there is none of that in Mozart. And so it is difficult, but particularly what it is difficult is to capture the style, that freshness, that spontaneity. At the same time, you need to have a very classically proportioned structure in mind and to make it work. So it's always a challenge, but I was talking from a physical standpoint. It is obviously so well written for the keyboard, Mozart being a keyboardist of genius, that, you know, it just makes it fun. It's not torturous, you know, and contorted like, for example, some of Schumann music can be, or some Brahms can be.
In what way?
In what way?
Yeah.
In a way that it twists your fingers because it was written by somebody who didn't, you know, really care for to write in a linear pianistic way, but just cared for the music, and the music came first. With Mozart, it's one thought process. The music comes to him already conceived for the instrument it's going to be played on. That's why it's the same is true for piano music written in completely different styles and different eras, like Rachmaninoff's or, you know, Liszt's. It doesn't have to do with the level of difficulty, just the level of, how can I put it in words? It just the way that your hands take place on the keyboard and mold to the keys rather than having to contort them to make it work.
And it's interesting that the pianists, I just gave it away, the composers you mentioned all happen also to have been pianists.
Yeah.
But obviously
Oh, yeah.
They had a different idea about how to put their own pianism into music, and they must have had difficulty playing it themselves.
Well, Schumann and Brahms were not particularly noted for their abilities as pianists. Schumann himself, you know, tried, and well, he even ended up ruining his own hands, one finger in particular, and having to give up the idea of being a pianist. And Brahms was harshly criticized when he performed. That might have been one of the causes why his first piano concerto was very coldly received when it was first performed, because he was the pianist for it. Of course, we don't have any recordings, so we'll never know. But based on, you know, some letters, some documents that we have left, and it reflects into the music. For them, music came first, and the medium was less important. That's all.
And obviously not the case with Mozart. In fact, this program, in a way, Mozartian all the way through, has Rossini on it, Tchaikovsky, and then these two Mozart pieces, Eine kleine Nachtmusik, and this ending with the concerto. You're probably not accustomed to being the last thing on the program.
Well, actually, it happens sometimes. It usually doesn't happen when I'm playing Mozart.
Right.
But when I'm playing a big romantic concerto, yes, it sometimes happens.
I think it's delightful, actually, because the concert is focused on Mozart. So in this case, bringing the virtuosity to the fore is sort of the show. It's the showpiece of the concert, which I think is great.
Oh well. I didn't even know that I was last on the program, actually. I learned it from you.
How about that? No kidding. Well, yeah. I just spilled the beans. Gear yourself up. Yeah, you're ending the program.
Yeah, well, you know, that's one of the things that always happens. I never know where I am on the program or what the program is going to be until I get there. In this case, I knew what other works would be featured on it because David had told me. But we hadn't talked about the order of performance, and, of course, I left that entirely up to him as it's right. that it be. I was going to find out once I got there, but now you told me, and so I know.
Well, my apologies to David if he meant to, if he wanted to be the spiller of the beans, but I've done it. So what can we
do
now?
No, no.
Well, I hope you have a grand concert. It's an honor, I'm sure, for you to be joining with him in this inaugural concert and with all the players there.
It definitely is, and I hope that the Heartland Festival Orchestra will have a luminous future and a long one, and so that this first concert can be sort of part of its history and always remembered as a good performance. That's what I hope.
Conversation with Antonio Pompobaldi, who will be performing the 23rd Piano Concerto of Mozart with the Heartland Festival Orchestra, conducted by David Commandi, in its inaugural concert this Friday evening at 7:30 at Five Points Washington Caterpillar Performing Arts Center in Washington, Illinois. For more information, heartlandfestivalorchestra.org. This is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. This afternoon will be sunny with a high of 82. Tonight, clear, the low 57. Tomorrow, sunny, the high 85. We're at 72 degrees. News headlines are next. More classical music for you at 1:06. This is WYLL 90.9 FM and HD Urbana, operating translators W293 AF Danville and W266 AF Urbana, the listener-supported broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois.